From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. At this point, a lot has been written about the Koch brothers, Charles and David, the billionaire brothers who have been providing hundreds of millions of dollars to promote their right-wing libertarian cause. The historian Nancy McLean says what's been missing in the reporting, though, is the true origin story of the Koch brothers' master plan. McLean believes she's found the missing piece of the puzzle that explains the intellectual origins of the Kochs' expansive network. She says it's James McGill Buchanan, a Nobel Prize-winning economist who gave the radical right a plan, a mechanism, a way of exploiting the rules of the game to alter the very nature of democratic governance. McLean is joining us today to talk about what she's found. Her book is called Democracy in Chains. Join us after the news.
Each morning as you drive the kids to school, KUER's Radio West team is preparing a new conversation that explores the way the world works. They connect with scholars, authors, and interesting people and delve into the questions that bring context and understanding, so that when 9 o'clock rolls around, you can spend an hour expanding your mind and heart. Trusted voices powered by you. Support Radio West today at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The historian Nancy McLean didn't really know that much about the economist James McGill Buchanan at first. In fact, she says she kind of stumbled onto his work. She found his archive and started digging through it, and she says she began to piece together a story of how Buchanan began to develop his ideas, and not only that, how he started to really train a generation of thinkers to challenge the overreach of the federal government. She also started to see how his intellectual philosophies came to be transformed into this mechanism for the radical right, how his ideas came to be associated with an expansive network funded by the Koch brothers, and how important stealth would come to be for this movement, too. Her new book is called Democracy in Chains, The Deep History of the Radical Right's Stealth Plan for America. And Nancy McLean is joining us today to talk about it. She's the William Chaffee Professor of History and Public Policy at Duke University, the author of a number of books. She's joining us today from a studio on the campus of Duke University in Durham, North Carolina. And Professor McLean, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, Doug. I'm delighted to be with you and in conversation with Utah listeners.
I want to begin with, I mentioned in the introduction how you discovered James Buchanan. Sheer serendipity. Just explain, it's a good story, how you kind of stumbled upon him.
Yeah, I had never heard of either James Buchanan or Charles Koch when I started the research that became this book in 2006. I was actually looking at the state of Virginia's reaction to Brown versus Board of Education, and Virginia was leading the wider South in massive resistance to that federally mandated desegregation. And they were doing things like promoting vouchers, what we would call today vouchers. They called them tuition grants for private segregation academies. The governor was mandated to shut down any school that desegregated, and the NAACP was denied its free speech rights and more in this suite of massive resistance laws. And what was so interesting to me as I started to dig into this story was to learn that some free market economists had gotten involved in this fight early on, including Milton Friedman of the University of Chicago, and also James Buchanan. I happened upon when he and a colleague issued a 1959 report after it seemed that a moderate mobilization of white parents and even business people in Virginia had was leading to a compromise solution. He and his colleague tried to keep the fight going by issuing a report in the language of their discipline of economics, making the case that Virginia could afford two systems of schools if it sold off public resources to private operators, what we would today call privatization before that word existed.
Right. So in 2013, you went to read his archive at George Mason University. I think it's an interesting image of what you saw. File cabinets everywhere. And out in the open, I guess it was a person who was so interested in being stealth, his life's work was out in front of everyone, it seems.
Yeah, this is a funny thing. I think many of the economists and law professors who are involved in the academic operations funded by Charles Koch don't have much respect for historians, and therefore I don't think they thought very much about the materials that they were leaving behind, the documents they left behind that might be found by someone else. And so it was just a revelation to me to go into what was called Buchanan House, which had been his working office, and find all these papers, but particularly just stacked helter-skelter on a chair, documents about the implant that the Charles Koch and his operatives in various Koch operations had put into George Mason University, a public university just off the across the Potomac from Washington, D.C., and those documents revealed that this was a highly political and partisan operation that was leveraging Buchanan's reputation as a Nobel Prize winner in order to serve the Koch political agenda. And it came to my attention because a whistleblower had sent those documents to Buchanan as well as to other administrators. And so there they were in a manila folder, and it was just fascinating to read them against the background of all else I had found in Buchanan's archives, in his published writing, and in other archives around the country. I would note, too, that there's an interesting local connection for you all in that the University of Utah now has a Koch grant either accepted or pending, and I know there's been some real faculty pushback on that with a letter signed by over 100 faculty members expressing deep and understandable concern about this implant. And I have to say, based on what I've seen at George Mason and other institutions where the Kochs have created these academic base camps, they're right to be alarmed.
So we're going to dig in to the particulars as we go. Generally, give us a sense of what it was you started to piece together and see. Because you say the more you spent time with this, a story starts to emerge. The documents start to tell you something. Just take me through that just briefly, generally what you started to see.
Yeah. Well, I would take the story back a little bit earlier, because when I found that 1959 report by Buchanan and his colleague in a new writing under the imprimatur of a new center that they had established at the University of Virginia in Charlottesville, I got intrigued by how anyone would do such a thing, a scholar would do such a thing, because they did say on their letter to some of the segregationist officials that they were, quote, letting the chips fall where they may in issuing this report. And as a social and political historian, I well understood that the chips would fall particularly harshly on black students. So that intrigued me. And then I learned from another passing reference by a comparative political scientist that Buchanan's Virginia School of Political Economy had had a more lasting effect on Chile under the Pinochet dictatorship than Milton Friedman's Chicago school, which had gotten much more attention. So that also intrigued me and got me reading more of Buchanan's published work. And then I moved to North Carolina in 2010, just as a Tea Party remodeled Republican Party won majorities in both houses of the General Assembly and proceeded to roll out a whole suite of very, very radical changes to this once moderate state. And I actually don't believe that I could have written this book, I could have understood Buchanan's thought, had I not witnessed what was happening in North Carolina with these Koch-funded political actors rolling out this plan. And so then I began piecing all that together. And then, as I mentioned, it was in 2013 when Buchanan died that I was able to get into his private papers and see my developing understanding really confirmed by what I found there.
Yeah. Let's go back a bit, because you mentioned that this the intellectual concept or part of this idea goes back almost 200 years. In fact, you believe that the kind of the earliest incarnation of Buchanan's ideas are espoused by John C. Calhoun, former vice president, U.S. senator. Mm-hmm. Explain this, if you would. Calhoun, you say, and Buchanan later, created what you call these mechanisms to protect an elite economic minority.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, I think, you know, as a U.S. historian, I have noticed, as have many others, and particularly people who work on early America, that there's always been a tension in our country between the notion of we the people, which is a more democratic notion, and the deep concern for protecting property rights, which is also a part of our tradition and our Constitution. What was interesting to me was to learn that two of Buchanan's colleagues at George Mason University, Tyler Cohen and Alexander Tabarrok, had said that John C. Calhoun, this South Carolina pro-slavery senator who also dabbled in political science, was a, in their words, precursor to James Buchanan's School of Political Economy. And that the Buchanan's two colleagues, these two men, said that Buchanan's ideas had the same purpose and effect as John C. Calhoun's theories. And that was fascinating to me because John C. Calhoun was the most anti-democratic theorist in American political history still to this day. I think he and James Buchanan might rival for that title. But his ideas were revived for the fight against Brown versus Board of Education in Virginia, just as James Buchanan arrived to chair the economics department at the University of Virginia in Charlottesville. And so those ideas were really in the air. And what Calhoun was doing was reinterpreting the Founders' Constitution in a quite radical way that actually appalled James Madison to make property rights supreme. He was concerned to protect property rights because the South was the most profitable, ran the most profitable economy in the country with human slavery. There were more millionaires in Mississippi in 1860 than in New York City, and per capita, I should say. Calhoun wanted to make sure all of this system was protected from the reach of democratic institutions, and particularly he feared the growing numbers of Northern voters opposed to Southern slavery. And so he came up with this theory of the Constitution that would essentially make property and states' rights sacrosanct to entrench that institution. And Buchanan then picks up that same system of ideas to protect corporate power and the power of wealthy minorities from democratic decision-making well over 100 years later.
It would require amending the Constitution. It would require a constitutional convention to do this?
Yes, and this is a quite frightening thing, yes. Most Americans are not aware of this, and I think particularly with all the attention being focused on President Trump at this point, we are being distracted from some crucial things that are happening in our political world. But the Koch donor network and the organizations that it funds and the politicians with whom it allies in state legislatures are pushing very hard for a constitutional convention. And listeners should be aware that we have not had a constitutional convention in the United States since 1787, right, when the document was crafted. So this is a quite radical enterprise. You need 34 states to call such a convention, and this donor network has ensured that they now have 27 states signed on. I'm happy to report that it was 28, but Common Cause worked hard in New Mexico to withdraw New Mexico's authorization. So now it's 27. But
isn't the way in for a lot of these organizations, the balancing the budget. But I guess the problem is once you have a convention and you're talking about balancing the budget, you could talk about other things too, I suppose.
Yes. And I think, you know, to many people, balancing the budget seems like a great idea, you know, and they often use, as Buchanan did in his early work, the notion of households balancing their budgets. But a federal government is very different from a household in that a federal government needs to sometimes prime the pump in times of recession or depression or, for that matter, war. It needs to have that latitude. And also, we have continuing expenses like Social Security and Medicare, which would be extremely vulnerable to such a balanced budget amendment. Also, the protection of our air quality, our water, our national parks, and more would be vulnerable in such a convention. And they are – the Koch network is coming into such a convention with about – I believe it's 10 so-called liberty amendments that that they would want to push through, which also include voter suppression measures, an effort to revoke the progressive era direct election of senators and have them appointed again by state legislatures, which are always more amenable to business, and a whole suite of other things. So this is a very, very radical proposition, and it's not getting nearly the attention it needs because it would utterly lead to utter transformation, I believe, of our society and our politics and make this country an utterly unsustainable society and political system.
Nancy McLean is with us. She's a professor of history and public policy at Duke University. Her book is Democracy in Chains, The Deep History of the Radical Right's Stealth Plan for America. We'll take a quick break, then come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the historian Nancy McLean, who is working us through her explosive new book, where she lays out what she says is an organized and well-funded effort to fundamentally alter the rules of democratic governance by the radical right. And her focus is a brilliant economist, James McGill Buchanan, who McLean says devised a blueprint for a libertarian takeover of American politics. The book is called Democracy in Chains, The Deep History of the Radical Right's Stealth Plan for America. And Nancy McLean, who's a professor of history and public policy at Duke University, is joining us from a studio at Duke to talk about it. Let's back up and talk a little bit about James Buchanan's early life. Born in a small village in Tennessee. And of course he was a man of his time, I suppose, and place. Was he a racist, do you think?
You know, it's interesting because some of his colleagues have raised this question and been very animated about it. And I think I would flip the question a little bit to say that for a white man born to a landed family that had black tenants in Tennessee and grew up in 1919 and through the Depression and the Jim Crow era, it would be rather surprising if he wasn't a racist.
Right.
It would be extremely surprising. And nothing in his published work or private letters led me to believe that he was not, although I don't really think that that's the most important question.
Right.
I think that when Buchanan set to work in Charlottesville in 1956, he was a University of Chicago economics PhD recipient. He was part of something called the Mont Pelerin Society, or he would be become the following year. They invited him into membership. This was a project to radically transform global institutions in what some call a free market fundamentalist direction, some say neoliberal. But he was part of that. And what stunned me is that he used the Virginia schools crisis with the fate of black children hanging in the balance to push these ideas, to exploit that crisis, to move that ultra-free market agenda. So to me, the real question that's important to, you know, scholars and citizens is not, was this man in his heart a racist, but rather how did he use this crisis as an opportunity to promote an extreme form of thought that otherwise had no constituency at the time? And by doing so, he actually was part of helping to develop a mass constituency for these ideas that ultimately remodeled the Republican Party and based it in the South in a quite self-conscious effort to appeal to recalcitrant white voters who were opposed to Brown versus Board of Education, the Civil Rights Act, and more.
He was influenced early on by a group called the Nashville Agrarians, and a figure named Donald Davidson, I think, is interesting, believed the federal government was growing and had become a totalitarian, I think is how he put it. And Davidson uses the term Leviathan to describe the federal government. And Buchanan sort of adopts that idea, really, the image even.
Yes. And I mean, the term Leviathan goes back to the Bible. So it has an ancient lineage. And it is also part of Thomas Hobbes' political writings, you know, when he was developing early social contract theory, you know, hundreds of years before Buchanan set to work. So there's a longer lineage. But there's a distinctive way that Buchanan used the notion of Leviathan to really focus interest on people who were going to the government, seeking government actions on issues of broader concern, whether they were labor issues or civil rights matters or even later retirees seeking security in their old age. All these kinds of things were really what Buchanan was worrying about and thinking about and analyzing. And so he used the term Leviathan in a quite distinctive way to say that the federal government had grown to an extent that was dangerous to liberty and that the particular mechanism that led to that growth was collective action by, you know, again, you would think, you know, labor unions, civil rights groups, retirees, others who made claims on government for the use of tax revenues for public purposes that had majority support, but did not have the support of the wealthy minority in many cases.
You write about how Buchanan was drawn to this kind of older style of political economy. Less interested, you say, in the sort of mathematics equation part of being an economist, and more interested in the social contract part, the idea of governance. Talk a little bit about that, because he wants to apply these ideas in real ways, I guess.
Yes. And when he set to work, you know, mathematical derring do was sort of the stuff of economics, as it still is. And so he wanted to bring attention back to fundamental questions of who gets what and why. He was trained in public finance, which meant he put particular attention on questions of taxation, of how government gets its revenue, how government spends its revenue, and things like that. So those were his preoccupations. Absolutely, yes.
He went to Italy, you mentioned, and he – I'm not sure if he had an epiphany there, but you mentioned him suddenly seeing the light, the idea of curtailing taxes and containing government spending, this idea of paying as you go. Something seemed to come to him there in Europe, did it?
Yes, he said that he had gotten that from a particular Italian tradition of public finance. But what was interesting to me, too, is that what he said that he found in Italy was so like what he would have learned growing up in the South among conservative white Southerners in his period. Certainly Harry Byrd, who was the most powerful figure in Virginia in the mid-20th century as first a governor and then a senator from Virginia. Harry Byrd always emphasized pay as you go. And there are photos of him scrutinizing every single federal budget line by line. So he was very devoted to this. And Virginia was the most parsimonious state relative to wealth in the South, which is saying quite a lot in those years. And so Buchanan, it was interesting, was basically I think perhaps finding resonances in Italy for what he also would have known as a conservative white Southerner of his era. But it was very much an approach that not only cast doubt on public spending for public purposes, for, you know, public investments, whether it be in strong public school systems or in roads or in other kinds of improvements, but one that also cast a particularly jaundiced idea on popular mobilizations, again, whether it be from workers or civil rights activists or retirees or others who would make these claims on government.
Buchanan wins the Nobel Prize for this school of economics called public choice. Let's talk a little bit about that. First, give us a sense of what the concept is. Basically, it's the idea that politicians, I guess, act out of self-interest. But explain what this is and what it means that he wins the Nobel Prize. I mean, he saw it as vindication.
Right. Yes, absolutely. So Buchanan described what he was doing as the economic analysis of politics. And that is certainly true, but it was also the economic analysis of politics from a particularly narrow, I would say, economic point of view that assumed that we are all self-interested, rational actors seeking our own personal self-interest. And so he said years later in a documentary looking back, to give you a sense of the import of this, he said that when he set to work in the late 1950s, the idea, the concept of the public interest was dominant. And he said, that's what I wanted to tear down. And that's his verb, you know, that's what I wanted to tear down. So, you know, again, it intrigued me to think, why would anyone want to tear down the idea of the public interest? But I came to learn that he wanted us all to imagine ourselves and others as isolated individuals only acting to advance our own self-interest. And his colleague, Gordon Tullock, once said that, co-author Gordon Tullock said that they were taking the barroom approach to politics. And making it scholarly, you know, saying that politicians are crooks and voters are selfish and stupid and so forth and so on. And really, that's kind of what he did. And that was an interesting heuristic tool, you could say, to raise some questions about who does what in politics and why. But over time, it really calcified into a rigid dogma that assumed that people were only seeking their self-interest without looking at all to their actual motives, to what they said, to evidence one way or another that could interrogate why people were doing what they were doing. And why that matters, I think, is that it says so much about our currently toxic political culture in which these ideas have been inculcated on the right for decades now. And we see people talking, you know, about the swamp. You know, I was talking to a friend whose family is from Alabama. Her sister had just said, good, I hope Donald Trump destroys Washington, D.C. There's nothing worth saving. And the woman who said that is a good Christian and a public school teacher. So that tells you how far things have gone with the kind of crude version of these public choice ideas.
Is there a common good? What did Buchanan believe about the idea of a common good? He didn't really believe in that idea.
No, he didn't. He believed that the criteria for identifying a common good was unanimity. Yeah. That would be when we would know there was a common good or a public interest, when you had unanimity on a public purpose. Now, you know, anybody who thinks seriously about this realizes that it's almost impossible to get unanimity on anything in public life. So that is a very high bar. He did know that, and he explored, you know, various kind of game theoretic models for thinking about, you know, what shy of unanimity would be a good standard. But I think it's really relevant to point out that his approach from the very beginning was critiqued for a lack of any empirical interest or documentation. So these are basically theories. They are basically thought experiments, but they have been informing the right for decades now and shaping our public policy with deleterious consequences that I think are now coming home to many Americans.
With current research, current economic theory, current social science, do you think the idea of public choice has been debunked in almost in some way?
Well, not from what I've heard from many political scientists. There are some political scientists who have really, really welcomed democracy in chains because they say it is spurring a long overdue conversation about these public choice ideas and the broader constitutional economics that Buchanan and his Virginia School developed. So the ideas are still quite influential. But again, here's an example of how these ideas have calcified into a rigid dogma that I'm saying is deleterious to the public interest. This school of thought is so hostile to the notion of government doing anything that they are engaged in climate science denial. Because if you pay attention to climate science, you know, I think it's 97% of all the scientists who are working on these matters understand that climate change is man-made and demands attention. And the only bodies with the strength to address the threat to our planet are governments. And this libertarian cause is so deeply and dogmatically opposed to the use of government power that they cannot accept the science of climate change. And they have funded efforts to deny that science and even to defame the scientists who are working in good faith to identify what's happening to our societies and how it is worsening the impact of hurricanes like the ones we've seen over the last few months and so forth. So I think that that understanding is really crucial for people to have of how dogmatic this has become. And that's why it's such a concern, too, that the Koch Donor Network and the Charles Koch Foundation in particular is making such a play to get access to university campuses and to implant centers on university campuses, because many administrators don't know that other wings of this Koch apparatus are engaged in that defamation of climate scientists and efforts to deny what all good science shows us to be the reality.
I want to get back to Charles Koch here in a moment when he when he first encounters James Buchanan. I want to talk about Buchanan's efforts in Chile, which are fascinating. Central to your thesis and to Buchanan's worldview, it seems, is this conflict between economic liberty on one hand and political democracy on the other hand. It seems like Buchanan saw those two ideals as at an impasse. You couldn't get both.
Yes.
And it's interesting when he is asked to advise the government in Chile, the government of Augusto Pinochet. Talk a little bit about the advice that he gives to them, because you mentioned that he gives them basically, here's how you put it in your book, he gives them detailed advice on how to bind democracy over the course of these lectures. And I wanted to go through the suggestions that he has for them. But set this up for us, if you would.
Yes, I'd be happy to. So Buchanan was invited to Chile in 1980, and he was going to Chile. But by that point, by 1980, Chile was an international pariah for its human rights violations. The dictatorship had come to power in 1973, had slaughtered thousands of civilians, had suppressed all forms of popular power from student organizations to workers' organizations, to rural farmers' organizations, to the free press, everything. And actually, just before he came, there was a purge of universities that was widely reported. Chile by then had assassinated Orlando Letelier on the streets of Washington, D.C., and killed an American civilian who was traveling with him. So the U.S. government would not allow people to go officially as guests of the Chilean regime because they considered it a terrorist regime. So in that, but Pinochet was a hero to the free market cause for his efforts to institute economic liberty, as they described it, in Chile. So it was really quite a stunning thing for me to learn that he was invited and that he went, and then that he gave these lectures that were reported in the regime, the only newspaper that was allowed to publish under the regime. It was closely allied with the regime, and Buchanan actually wrote to the editor afterwards to thank him for getting his remarks so capturing them so accurately. So I know he approved of what was reported. And this is a man who had mocked liberal economists and moderate economists for giving advice to political figures without regard to the rules in which they operated that might sway their decisions. And here he was addressing a military junta and its civilian partners in the most right wing of Chile's corporate class, and he gave detailed advice with language like must, should, you know, ought to.
Can I read a few of these? He said the Constitution, this Constitution that they should drop, needed severe restrictions on the power of government. He said the first such restriction is that the government must not be free to spend without also at the same time collecting the necessary taxes to offset expenses. It must have a constitution that requires a balanced budget. The government should be denied the authority to make monetary policy because doing so would lead to inflation. On and on, and it's quite detailed.
Yes. Absolutely. And what's really, I think, interesting, especially interesting to American listeners about what happens in Chile is that this is the kind of constitution that the Koch donor network would like to bring to America. Right. And what happened in Chile was that under the dictatorship, they essentially privatized most of public education. They privatized health care. They privatized Social Security such that Chileans ended up with individual accounts invested with the Chilean financial sector, which gouged them on the charges and then misbehaved like our financial sector has in the U.S. And many people lost their savings, their entire life savings as a result of this. So these were really devastating measures for a lot of Chileans. And when an elected government came into being, they tried to change a lot of it, but it was a much heavier lift on some of these deep structural reforms. And in just 2013, Michelle Bachelet, a president who was elected mm-hmm. by almost two-thirds of the Chilean people on a broad-ranging reform program that had actually been spearheaded by college students who were angry about Chile having one of the highest costs of college of any of the developed nations, when she got into office and tried to act on this popularly supported reform program, she found that she could not because of what she described as the authoritarian trammels of the so-called Constitution of Liberty. And she said that the Chilean people needed a constitution without locks and bolts. That was her phrase, locks and bolts. And I think that is crucially important for American listeners to understand because all of us believe in a constitution of checks and balances, I think. You know, we certainly would not have had the Brown decision had it not been for the recognition that sometimes individual constitutional rights need to be protected from, in that case, segregationist majorities of those who were then enfranchised. But this is something quite different. This is making it impossible, virtually, for the government to act on widely shared concerns. And so I think that Chile story is really of interest to Americans now, particularly in states that have authorized these constitutional conventions.
It's Nancy McLean. Her book is Democracy in Chains, The Deep History of the Radical Right's Stealth Plan for America. And we need to take another quick break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUPR. This is Radio West and Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with historian Nancy McLean. We're talking about her book, Democracy in Chains, The Deep History of the Radical Right's Stealth Plan for America. Professor McLean is a professor of history and public policy at Duke University. She's joining us from a studio on the campus. When does Charles Koch come to discover James Buchanan and his work?
Well, I have to go from the archival trail that I found. So it's possible that there were earlier contacts that I just don't know about. But what I was able to find in Buchanan's archives was contact that began about 1969, 1970, when Buchanan had co-authored a book that was basically, by the way, a blueprint for the kinds of radical changes the right is now proposing to public higher education. And Charles Koch's organization, the Center for Independent Education, found that that book very helpful to their work, and so they reprinted a kind of pamphlet version of it to circulate on the white right and to their allies. So that was 69-70. Then in 1970, Charles Koch joined this organization I mentioned before, the Mont Pelerin Society, mm-hmm. and he was organizing and recruiting for his various the organizations that he was funding through the Mont Pelerin Society. From the 1970s forward. And Buchanan himself also came to help with some early Koch enterprises, such as what we now know as the Cato Institute. Mm-hmm. And Buchanan was there from the beginning, helping to, you know, provide lectures and convene people to, you know, like-minded economists and others to talk about the issues and provide guidance, basically, for this effort. effort. So he's involved there. And then I believe that they drew closer after Buchanan went to Chile. And in 1983, Buchanan advised the Cato Institute's people, you know, in their publication on basically how to secure Social Security privatization, how to secure radical change in Social Security in the full knowledge that most Americans didn't want it. And what was stunning to me is he actually went through the various constituencies in America, and he said that nobody wanted radical change in Social Security, neither rich nor poor, nor black nor brown nor white, nor rural nor urban, you know, men or women, rich or poor, et cetera, et cetera. He just went through all of these demographic groups and said nobody wanted this, and therefore, in his term, it would be political suicide to argue for Social Security privatization honestly and directly on philosophical grounds. And now, to most of us, if we were confronted with a phalanx of popular support like that, we might say, well, then we should just let it be. This is something that works well and Americans want. But the Cato Institute didn't want Social Security to continue, nor did Buchanan. Both of them were philosophically opposed to the notion of social insurance. And so Buchanan advised on a kind of step-by-step strategy that basically involved misleading the public about the solvency of Social Security and then engaging in kind of divide and conquer efforts against Social Security, which ended with – he goes through several different groups that should be targeted in different ways, as I describe in the book. But the last one is young people. And he says that young people should be given the message that they are providing a tremendous welfare subsidy for the aged. And that was really interesting to me to see that deliberate effort to turn young people against Social Security recipients, because I think it also underscores how this cause is not conservative. It is flying under the flag of conservatism, because Charles Koch and other architects of this project understand that that's where the voter support is to be found. But this is a quite radical cause, and you can see that in their efforts to, in effect, instigate a kind of generational warfare with young people turning against their elders. And I don't know any conservatism in the world or any religious tradition that would authorize such efforts to turn the young against the old.
Hey, I guess the question that I had was whether or not Buchanan was on board with the deceit. You know, the idea of using trickery or deceive. Mm-hmm. It sounds like what you just said is that he was. In fact, he thought that was a pretty good strategy. But I wondered if the whole stealth idea implies, of course, that he's not interested in being entirely transparent with the masses about these ideas. But it seems like also philosophically that he may have wanted to, I guess, did he want his ideas to just rise on their own value in a transparent forum, or did he think they couldn't work like that?
Yeah, I'm so glad that you raised that, because that's a deep mystery that in some ways I just feel like with the available documentation we can't fully solve. Because here's the interesting thing. Buchanan, it is clear to me, was playing with fire by supplying these kinds of ideas to the political right and to extremely wealthy donors like Charles Koch over the years, who were very determined to remake our institutions in radical ways. And he was essentially supplying them with tools to do that. But I don't think he fully realized what he was doing. And so at the end of the book, and a spoiler alert, I guess we have here, but at the end of the book, what's fascinating to me is Buchanan recoiled from what Charles Koch and his operatives were doing at Buchanan's institution, George Mason University, and he wanted to disassociate himself from that. And he said that at minimum, his name was being exploited, and he was appalled at how they were bringing in all these basically political hacks and putting them in academic positions, and he was extremely embarrassed by the whole thing. So he actually, at the end, it's almost an anticlimax because he disassociates from the Kochs, but they go forward without him. And what was really disturbing to me, too, is that George Mason University's higher administration ended up essentially kicking their Nobel Prize winner, their first Nobel Prize winner, under the bus in order to please Charles Koch, who became the university's biggest donor. And they actually told Buchanan when he tried to apply the brakes, they said, no, we're determined to pursue this opportunity. Mm. And so in the end, he kind of retreated to his own center, something of a mystery figure, but I think in some ways a defeated and humiliated man. And yet he also said in a 2007 memoir, literally, this is a quote, literally, I have no regrets. Yeah. So, you know, readers might come to different conclusions right. about how to read James Buchanan's relationship to the Koch project that is spinning out now. Yeah. But I do know from a letter from Charles Koch's top political consigliere, as he's been called, Richie Fink, that they found Buchanan's ideas about how the political economy operates incredibly helpful in their efforts to promote this plan to radically transform our institutions.
There are those who follow Buchanan who believe – have become, as you say in the book, uneasy about the direction under Charles mm-hmm. Koch and others, that too much big money – is mm-hmm. in some ways distorting the cause, that's too dominated by wealthy individuals and foundations and executives. One person who believed the movement, and I'll quote him here, you, mm-hmm. was turning into a troubling form of coercion, which is ironic given the central concern is that government was coercing the individual. And now mm-hmm. this twist is coming, it seems, with the Kochs.
Yes, absolutely. And that's a problem, I think, with this libertarian economics and strategy is the failure to recognize extreme concentrations of private wealth as a form of power that can have a terribly distorting and even undermining effect in a democracy. And, you know, we could discuss and debate this and political theorists have over the ages, but, you know, many people have found in the American tradition an interesting tacking back and forth between efforts to expand democracy and efforts to have a vibrant, creative, capitalist economy. And that tension could be said to be productive in many ways. And so what's really unsettling here is that you have a group of people who are determined to undermine one side of that equation, what John Kenneth Galbraith, the leading economist in the 1950s, called countervailing power, mm-hmm. the idea that in a moderate corporate economy, private corporate wealth grows so significantly that you need the countervailing power of trade unions, of senior citizens groups, of consumer groups, and so forth to keep things in a kind of good equilibrium. And this Koch donor network is trying to undermine that completely and entrench property rights to a degree that actually we've seen in no society in the world. It's that radical. Yeah. So this is really, really serious stuff. And one thing that has been so interesting to me is not only did I find some people within this cause dissenting by the end of the book, but also I have gotten letters from people who had been part of this libertarian movement who are now refugees from it, people who were on the inside who are saying, you got this right, it is deeply troubling, but who can't make their voices heard among those libertarian groups because at this point, as one of the people I quote says, they've all become a kind of proxy army for Charles Koch.
It's interesting to see the critiques that you've gotten. This has certainly generated mm-hmm. a lot of debate. And we don't need mm-hmm. to go through all of them. I mean, some have said that the Calhoun connection didn't make any sense to them, and you've pushed back on that. But one thing that I did want to raise, and it's mm-hmm. something that Rick Perlstein, independent historian, brought up, and I know you've responded to this, but I wanted to give you a chance to say something about it. What he has said is that the foundation of the book is a conspiracy theory that maybe oversimplifies this as an idea that there's not one secret plan, not one mechanism devised by one brilliant economist, but there are other things that are playing into that. And you've responded by saying, yes, of course that's true. But I wanted to give you a chance to talk mm-hmm. about this idea that you have created a book built on a conspiracy theory, because I think you yourself have said, I don't really want it to be conveyed as a conspiracy theory. We don't have the right language.
It's not a conspiracy theory.
Right,
yeah, right. What Rick Perlstein said was a kind of a silly comment on Facebook, and I think he was annoyed because I didn't cite his books. But I said in the book, of course, there are other streams that are flowing into the right. You know, there are many streams. There's the religious right. There's the white supremacist right. There's the movement conservatism built around National Review. But we've had many books on those things. What we hadn't had any attention to whatsoever in trying to unpack the crisis in our politics is the ideas that are behind this Koch donor network and the way they go back to Buchanan and this Virginia School of Political Economy that he founded. So I was in no way saying this is the only thing we need to understand, but rather that this is a crucial piece without which we cannot understand the larger picture. So that's really the key thing to say there. And related to that, and I think I may add this actually in a preface, is of course I don't believe in conspiracy theory. I'm a historian. You know, scholars don't believe in conspiracy theories. That's just a canard, really. But what we do have before us is a serious problem for social analysis, and that's that we have allowed inequality to develop in our country to such a point that we now have a group of billionaires and multimillionaires, many of whom are part of this Koch donor network of hundreds, who have become profoundly hostile to our government as it has operated over the course of the 20th century in response to citizen pressure. And they are engaging in what legal scholars would call concerted activity. They have been doing so ever since the Mont Pelerin Society was founded in 1947 as an invitation-only society. So that is not a conspiracy, because a conspiracy by definition involves illegality, right, and this cause is wealthy enough to hire the best legal talent to keep them on the bright side of the law. But what do we do with a situation in which you have people for whom tens of million dollars are essentially chump change that you can invest in building up various organizations that are ostensibly separate but are working together to radically transform our society and institutions, including by the most radical gerrymander in history to misrepresent the will of the electorate, extreme voter suppression, efforts to call this constitutional convention, and so forth and so on. So we have a real challenge before us in trying to make sense of that, and that's what my book tries to draw attention to.
You quote the Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis, who said this, who said, "Americans need to make a choice. We may have democracy or we may have wealth concentrated in the hands of a few, but we can't have both." Let me ask you that finally. If that's the choice that we're confronted with, and you look at the political landscape and the social landscape now, what choice are we going to make as a country?
I do believe as a historian that we are at one of those fundamental turning points in our history. I believe that in terms of the contest between anti-democratic and democratic forces, it is the equivalent of the 1860s and the 1870s with the Civil War and Reconstruction to the 1930s and the Great Depression and the question of how we would respond to that and the 1960s in the response to in the civil rights struggle and the push for inclusive democracy that it set off. So I think this is one of these fundamental turning points, and that's why I wrote the book, to give people the knowledge they would need to make an informed decision when there are forces at work that want to permanently and radically change our institutions in a way that will make it extremely hard, if not impossible, for them to be changed back. I want readers and voters and citizens to be able to be fully informed about this, because the next 5 to 10 years will be absolutely pivotal for America.
Nancy McLean. Her book is Democracy in Chains, The Deep History of the Radical Right's Stealth Plan for America. She's a professor of history and public policy at Duke University, joined us from a studio there. Professor, thank you very much for taking the time.
Thank you very much, Doug.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. We had technical direction today from Michael Havey. Anthony Scoma is our intern. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.